Hello everybody, James here, and it is Ask Dutch Anything 16. We aren't going to do the plugs too quickly, apart from the fact that Dutch has got two behind him. The World According to Dutch and Tales from a Dirt Road. You can buy them on Amazon unsigned, or if you want them signed, you go to dirtydutchmantel2ls@gmail.com and you make your request there. He also has diplomas for sale that he signs twice. Oh, you've got one, good. Dutch Mantel, and also signed by
can you
the
see,
Pro.
Can you see that, or is it too bright?
No, I can see it just fine.
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, the name's a little big, but this is. It looks like that. That is a nice diploma to hang on your wall.
All ready to frame as well. And if you want one of those signed by Dutch Mantel and the Provost of the University of Dutch, Zeb Coulter, you also go to dirtydutchmantel2ls@gmail.com and you make your request there. I have two books as well, one on the Owen Hart, one on The Rock. You can get them from Amazon. Links are in the description for everything we say. We also have T-shirts. Two T-shirts, as a matter of fact, and also I have a podcast with Shane Douglas every Tuesday, the same day that this podcast comes out. It is called Franchise University with Shane Douglas, and you can find that on all podcast platforms, or you can go to YouTube, Shane Douglas Official, and see all the episodes as they come out at the same time as the podcast, as well as clips every single day.
How do we get a T-shirt?
What do you mean? T-shirt?
Yeah, how do the fans get a T-shirt?
Oh, there's links in the description of this video and every video. So you won't be found wanting for that kind of thing. But is there anything else? Yes, we're going to be asking your questions for the duration of this episode, except for the first one, for a reason that will become evident very, very soon. And if you want to send in a question for a future episode to be considered, you want to email questionsfordutch@gmail.com. And as I say every single time, dozens and dozens of you have been doing just that every single week. So we're picking the cream of the crop to ask the Dirty Dutchman, the crafty veteran from Oil Trough, Texas. But before we do, as we record this...
Right, go ahead.
I'm getting good at these intros. It's only taken me a year and a half.
Next time we see you, you'll be on Raw or SmackDown doing the announcing.
No, I don't think I could cope with that kind of pressure. I've got an audience of one at the moment, you know, doing it. So, anyway, as we're recording this, it is, let's give the game away, 6 p.m. local time on a Thursday. And 5 hours earlier, I posted a video from last Tuesday's episode featuring David Flair as the subject. Now, it's done incredibly well in the views. I was just telling Dutch. And then we got quite a lot of interesting comments as well. And one of them is from Anarchy. Your old friend, Anarchy from Puerto Rico.
From Puerto Rico.
Who's Anarchy to you?
What's that now?
Who's Anarchy to you then? So how
old are you? He was a guy that was, he's Puerto Rican, but he's lived in the States too. And he was one of the talents, the wrestler. And funny as hell, and he would do anything you want him to do. Very good, actually. So, and he was a good friend. He was.
The message reads: this was a comment on the video, public comment. I refereed David's last match in IWA. Do I even need to read this, or do you want to tell the story? Do you know what happened?
Well, I'll add to it at the end, but go ahead and tell them what it was.
David Flair, he wrestled Ray Gonzalez in Mayagüez. Am I pronouncing that right?
Mayagüez,
in a match with fans surrounding the ring with belts. Excuse me. During that match, all was good until he got tossed outside onto the floor and he spread his legs as the fans were whipping him with the belts and got struck in the balls and obviously screamed in pain. I went out and helped him get up. I yelled to the fans never to strike him again during the match because they hurt him for real. David was crying and wanted to stop the match. Ray pinned him and the match was over. He was crying and I was trying to calm him down. He never returned to the IWA.
See, this was after I had just left. But I just booked that match. And then I left because, and we talked about this last week, Rick wanted for him to learn the business. He wanted him to, no special treatment for him, no nothing. And he did have a little bit of heat going to the ring just by having the name Flair, being the son of Ric Flair, he'd wear the robes, he would do the strut, he had the blonde hair, he had everything. So, and we did a little deal with him. It's a Sunday town is what it was. And it was a, his fans surround the ring, and if you leave, the fans could legally hit you with a strap or a belt. Well, I don't know where he got it in his head that if he spread his legs, he wouldn't get popped in the balls. But apparently he did, and you know it hurt because those fans would wear your butt out.
Or your balls.
So, yeah, they would wear your little nutsack out. and I could see that he got hurt like that, and they shouldn't have done it. But I remember hearing about this match. I was in Nashville, and somebody called me and said, "That last match you booked was a good one. David Flair hates your ass, and he's gone." He left, I think he left the next morning, I heard. So when they're looking for David Flair, he was only there for like, a month, maybe 3 weeks. But and we went over this last week, Flair called me and said if I would take him down there, keep him for a couple of months, he would come in for two shots in the future. I never nailed a date down on him. But I guess once David got hit in the nuts, that was kind of over, and he didn't want to fulfill his obligation, and he didn't. So,
Dutch,
my apologies to you, David, and to your little testicles. I'm sorry, and it won't happen again.
Dutch, I'm going to blow your mind. He was in IWA for over 4 months.
Well, I just... Then he must have not left the next day. He could have left the next day. Yeah. What month was this happened? I left in like October.
Yeah, he joined in July, and he left in late November.
Okay, well, that's about right. He was there a couple of months.
So there you go. So also someone else wrote in the comments as well. I don't normally reference comments, but. Someone else wrote that Ric Flair did the I'll turn up for you gag and then not turn up for Dory Funk as well for taking David Flair and teaching him the ropes. I mean, keep in mind that David Flair was in the business for over 4 years at this point, and still still he was as green as owl shit as Ricky Morton.
He didn't understand the business. See, if you watch Flair's matches toward the end, every match is the same. Every match is the same blueprint for every match he had. He had the figure four. He had over the top, throw me off the top rope, do this, do that. But it was basically the same kind of a structured match that he had 1,000 times. So now if little David had a little bit of more talent, I think he could have done something in the business. He had the strut. He had the natural heat. You wanted to punch him. And he brought his girlfriend with him, too. So, I don't know. It was a messed up deal. But there were very few places for David to go to train. This was before WWE, what's their center called?
The Performance Center.
It was before that. They had a few of them around like that. I think they had Louisville. Mm-hmm. And I think they may have had Memphis as just offshoots of what the Performance Center became later. But he never got there.
Yeah. Well, he did go to OVW, and then he had one match on Raw and one match on Velocity and a dark match. Mm-hmm. A couple more OVWs, and he went to Germany, it seems. Then England. He had an axe handle on a pole match versus Kurt Hennig in early 2003 in TNA. A few TNA matches, a few Heat Velocity Dart matches, Puerto Rico, pretty much nothing else. A brief run in All Japan, would you believe? and then pretty much nothing. Okay, we shall move on. Okay, first fan question is from Stuart Bonington. I've got a feeling this is going to be a very short answer. Years ago, I attended a show in North Georgia, an indie show. There was a wrestler named Butch Mantell. Is he related to you?
No, but I know who you're talking about. He's from Chattanooga.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Butch Mantell. And I remember him from years and years and years ago. And his father was, I think his father was Harry Thornton. He was the announcer. This is what I think. But it's been years since I've been over there, so I don't know if I'm even close. But they were, I do remember a Butch Mantell.
It's just like a Jack Pfeffer kind of thing.
It was, the guy wasn't very good, so I couldn't claim him as part of my lineage.
Next question. Derek Anderson. Hi, James and Dutch. I love the podcast and shoot interviews. You both do a bang-up job, rightly so. My question is for Dutch relating to international pro wrestling from Arkansas in the late 80s, early 90s. Other than Bill Ash, there are no recognizable people except for the infamous Jumpin' Jeff Farmer and his legendary promo on Motley Crue. We're going to watch that in a second. I was wondering if Dutch had any information about this federation, as resources are quite scarce on the internet. Thanks.
What's the name of the company?
So,
listen, folks, when you ask me about these independents, I bet they have 1,000 independents across the country. And just because it was from Arkansas and that's close to Memphis, I'm probably not familiar with it. So what are we going to watch here?
Okay, this is frequently cited as the best wrestling promo ever. Jumping Jeff Farmer. One second. Okay, here we go. Just before I started recording again, you went, who is this guy? Hopefully he's going to announce himself. Let's see.
Farmer, let's go now to that interview. Folks, there's Jumpin' Jeff Farmer. Jeff, a while back, what a match you had with Motley.
Yep. Probably the hardest match I ever had in my life. But I don't like it when things aren't going my way. Motley Crue's. You turn the tables on me.
Pre-recorded, by the way.
You turn the tables in a wrong way. You've got me mad now. I've stood around. I've listened to everything you had to say. I've did everything necessary. But when you turn around and you backstab me one way or another, and you cheat me out of what's rightfully mine, that's when I get angry. Now I'm the one doing the challenging. I'm issuing a challenge to you, Motley Crue's. Get in the ring with me. This time, I'm going full force.
Jumping Jeff Farmer. Now let's go to the ring.
So,
folks, there's Jumping Jeff Farmer.
Here's the best bit. Here's the best bit. Let's just do it again.
Jeff, a while back, what a match you had with Motley.
Yep.
Yep. And that's it.
Yep. Oh, my God. I've seen that. I've seen that before. Boy, he's pissed off.
Yeah.
I bet.
His balls are about to descend. That's how pissed off he is.
Yeah. But see, he never says where. He never says, is he wrestling Motley Crue?
Crue's, apparently. Like, cousin of Tom.
And he didn't say a date. He didn't say a building. He didn't say a town. He didn't say nothing except, yep, I'm kind of pissed off now. Oh. That is hilarious. That is a keeper. So, yeah. And I remember seeing this years ago. Jumping Jeff Farmer. JJF. That's pretty good.
Mm.
Thanks for showing me that.
Yeah. Future World Championship material, I'm sure. Oh, dear. Right, let's go to the next one then. Which one am I looking at? Here we go. Dino D. Hi. I was wondering if you could ask Dutch about Uptown Karen. She was a wrestler in the USWA. Allegedly, Downtown Bruno was overseas and met this woman from Scotland who thought... Do I even need to say anymore?
No, go ahead. Uptown. Okay. I don't know whose idea this was, but he'd met her and...
Karen thought Bruno, being in wrestling, was rich. She was supposedly married to him. Suffice to say, Bruno did not exactly live a life of luxury, and Karen was none too pleased.
Yeah, I remember that. I don't know whose idea it was, but he was Downtown Bruno, and he left, and he came back. Allegedly, he had gotten married while he was gone, and her name was Uptown Karen. I don't know where they got these names. And she was under the impression he was a big time wrestler, had a lot of money, and then found out he lived in a truck or a motel or something. And they had all kind of trouble. But I do remember that. I don't remember the conditions of it. I wish I'd have had more to fill in there, because I think I could have made that actually a pretty good little angle between the two of them. But, and I don't know who played her, some girl wrestler around Memphis. Hey, Memphis has done crazy stuff. People ask me, you remember that? You remember that? I remember some of it, but most of it, I heard about it, like a lot of fans hear about it from a distance. And you can tell by the way people would talk about it, whether it was worth a shit or not.
Next one, Jamie T. Do you have any memories from Florida or elsewhere of the Nature Boy, Buddy Rogers?
I never met Buddy Rogers.
You're kidding. I thought he was in Florida for quite a long time, in the 70s.
He was, but I may have met him. I think I may have met him. Roger Kirby was there. I think he teamed up with him, maybe. But, you know, when you're starting out in the business and a star comes in, see, Buddy Rogers, the real Buddy Rogers?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he made Florida, because he was a big star.
I know he did, because in the 70s, Don Morocco was in Florida, maybe like 74, 75, and he always had stories about, even called him BR, Buddy Rogers, sorry. So, yeah, he was in the early 70s in Florida.
Buddy Rogers, the original...
Nature Boy, yeah.
Nature Boy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember him. I know who you talk about, but I don't remember him.
He couldn't have been.
This is what Florida would do. Florida would book guys for like 2 weeks or a month, no more. And they'd come down, lay on the beach, drink beer, have a good time. But this would be, how old would Buddy Rogers have been at this time?
Oh, cool. Probably like late, God, in the 70s, like late 40s or something at that point. Maybe even 50.
Well, and he probably came down, but I don't think he made the loops. Buddy, Eddie Graham was probably his big buddy. So he would come in and he'd make TB and he'd probably make Miami and some of the big towns, and that's it.
Where do you rank Corona?
I like Corona.
Hmm? Lime or no lime?
Oh, I can take it either way, but I like Corona. That's the national beer of Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
Corona.
Just thought I'd ask. I never drink during podcasts, but I thought I'd treat myself because I'm tired.
Mm-hmm.
Next question. Benji, not too long ago, Conan and Disco Inferno were discussing Loki's issues that stopped him rising up the ranks. Conan also said that you and Jeff Jarrett... yes, I was actually going to play the clip, but they've played stuff of ours, so they won't... They can't be upset if we play one of their clips, can they?
Should we play it? It's kind of long, though. Is it mostly talking?
It's all talking. It's like a minute,
yeah,
maybe. I'll tell you what. I'll just do the quick version. Conan said that you and Jeff Jarrett blocked Loki from going into LAX because Loki had major heat with you both. The second time Conan tried to get Loki into LAX, he briefly succeeded before Loki got suspended from TNA for getting into a fight with Jeff Jarrett. What's the whole story here? So apparently Loki has got heat with you and Jeff. So where does that stem from?
Well, he doesn't have heat. He just doesn't have a full endorsement. Let me say that. Loki's a great worker, but he's very difficult to work with. You would want him to do something, and he would sit back and he would go, well, you know, in great voice.
Well.
When you hear the voice of God, you go, well, hell, am I wrong on this or what? But he would really study every aspect of what he was going to do. And if he didn't like one part of it, he'd want to discuss it. Well, I don't got time to stand around and discuss just a regular match with the guy, because it's up to you to keep yourself. If you don't want to do it, don't do it. But none of it would have hurt him. He was going over in the match, but he presented it in such a way that it became more of a problem to even talk to him about a match where he was going over and he'd want to make sure this and that, and yeah, just get yourself over. And I didn't want to, and the discussion with Loki wasn't like 2 or 3 minutes. It was like at least 15, 20, because he would want to just keep over and over. I don't have time for it. So he was difficult to work with. And Jeff is the same way, because I think he went to Jeff with some of the problems and Jeff didn't have time to deal with him either. So that's where his, not heat, but we just didn't endorse him to go in LAX. Conan did. And then the first week, what did he do? He got in a fight with somebody or a big tiff with Jeff or something?
Yeah, that's basically it. Apparently, he got suspended for getting into some sort of fight with Jeff Jarrett. I don't know if verbal or otherwise.
Well, I'm sure it was verbal, but... And Jeff didn't have time for it either. Hey, it's a business, and you got to treat it like a business. If we were a pro football team and you were a tight end and we want you to run this, you know, this down and out, well, you'd run the down and out, whether you like it or not. We got to see if we can make it work. But no, he wanted to question it. So it was easier to replace him than it was to pacify him.
Thank you, Sweet. If I can not cough all the way through it. Low key, looking at him, I wouldn't think he was a good fit for LAX, because if he's Hispanic or not, he looks like a Shaolin monk. So in that sense, I just sort of didn't think that LAX and him would be a good fit.
Well, Homicide was in it. What was the other guy's name?
Hernandez
and Conan. And they were a pretty good fit. And they wanted to put a third guy, do like the Freebird gimmick with them. And which would have been okay, but all he had to do was work a little bit, and it was Conan's choice, I think. And I think Conan saying he got in an argument with me, we wanted Conan to handle him, and Conan didn't handle him, so we had a problem.
There was also Salinas, Shelly Martinez, who was briefly in LAX, if you remember
She was there too for a while. And but see, but these are all Conan suggestions that we tried to see if we could get work, and she didn't work either. So,
now, did anyone ever come to you and complain that Loki was maybe a little bit more snug than they would prefer?
No, not really, because he was snug, but you know, when you lock up with a guy and he's snug, so you got to be snug back. You can't be loose on a guy that's snug, because he's snatching you. You got to snatch him. Nobody's going to get hurt unless you get kicked in the face, or in case of David Flair, in your little, you know, love balls. You might get kicked in them a little bit, but yeah, you know, I think the guy, he just liked to. He loved the business and he loved the physicality of it. So, and if you didn't like it, you know, you either had to be rough back with him or not at all.
Now, Conan, and tell me if you believe he's right, says that the reason that Loki didn't advance further in the business was essentially, I think the quote he gives is that Brandon, his real name, is a good guy. Loki's an arsehole. So, he uses that as the example of essentially why Loki didn't make it bigger in the business. Is that fair to say?
Well, I didn't know Brandon. I didn't know who he really was. Conan probably did. And that's probably a fair assessment of it. It really is. Because in any business, you have to play the game. I don't care what it is. You got the old saying, you got to go along to get along, or get along to go along. It's something like that. So you don't say everything you want to say, but I think he wanted every detail worked out. Well, that's his job. I can give you the finish. I can give you the story. Once I give you that, you got to get there. And if I see you're missing the mark, I will adjust some things. But still, the story is going to remain the same. So if you're hard to work with, you just take up valuable time that a lot of people in creative don't have time to give you, unless you're really the main story.
You ever seen Loki knock somebody out?
No, but
would you like
to? He does. Yeah, let me see it.
One sec. Okay. So apparently this is Loki's debut in the Evolve promotion from 20... I haven't got the information. I think 2012.
And Evolve is where up on the East Coast.
I think so, yes. So, here we go. Oh, sugar, there we go. Waiting for the bell to ring. I'll figure out what this guy's name is in a second, his opponent. And there you go. He's dead.
What do you do to him?
Oh, let's see it again. He does like a rolling kick.
Oh, he knocked him out.
Yes. I think a few people have advanced that he wasn't knocked out, which in this case, that guy's the greatest seller of all time since Ricky Morton, so someone hire him immediately. But I think he was just knocked out.
So what's the finish here? Do they pull him out?
They stand around. So keep in mind that he's knocked out and this match goes 2 minutes, which tells you that obviously they try and rouse him up. I'm just forwarding up a bit. Still yet to get to his feet because he's knocked out completely. And anyone in a real contest would have pinned the guy.
Yeah.
But no, apparently that wasn't the plan. So there you go. He's...
So he kicked him twice.
He's dead on the thing. I'll forward it up. Double stomp. In fairness, he does actually protect him on the double stomp there, you can tell. And then he pins him, because apparently that was the actual finish.
Well.
It's one of those things. That's
pretty good. I'm glad it's not me.
It's one of those things where I just think, look, the guy is dead. The guy is dead. In a real fight, you would pin him. Just do it. You've been in the business 15 years. Just pin him.
Now, this is from Evolve.
Yeah. His debut.
Wasn't that Gabe Sapolsky that ran it?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, okay. And he used to book with ECW with Heyman, right?
That's at one point, he's like an understudy in the last years, yeah.
Yep. I think I met him one time. That's all I met him. I think he came to a TNA taping.
I think he did like NXT for a brief time as well, maybe, but I don't know.
Anyway.
We shall move. Oh, there you go. You've seen Loki knock a man out unconscious there.
Hey, so, he had a great look.
Yeah. Do you know, I mean, fair enough. He was undersized,
I do like, what did you say you would have put him in? A monk outfit?
No. I said he looked like a Shaolin monk. I wouldn't give him like the robes or anything. Like at an airport, the orange robes, and they give you like a... Have you never had that, where you go to an airport and the Shaolin monks are there and trying to get charity out of you?
No.
Have you never seen that before?
No.
So, I've seen it in airports. I've been accosted on the streets of New York City by orange bedecked monks, you know, with the skinhead and the whole thing. And what they do is they give you like this like gold like rectangle of like cardboard, and they say, "Here is a gift to you." And you take it and then go, "Oh, thanks." And then you walk off and then say, whoa, you got to pay me for that. And I was like, well, what kind of gift is that?
Yeah.
So basically, they're just panhandling.
They're just swapping.
Yeah.
They're giving you something, and what did they want in return?
Currency.
Did you give them something?
No. I was worried it was low key, so I ran away.
Well, wait a minute. I should have got 10 bucks out of you. Or here comes Loki rolling down the sidewalk and kicks you in the head. Then you're laid out. Then they rob you. You're laid out like that.
Do you know, I was missing about 3 hours that day and my wallet was empty when I woke up. So that may have been what happened. Right, let's move on. Sean, good morning, Dutch. It's afternoon. Good afternoon, Dutch. My name's Sean Hensley, and I met you in Puerto Rico in winter 1998. You were wearing a Stone Cold bandana and a pair of red silk Speedos, and that's it. Long story short, I worked for OPW in Oklahoma as the Atomic Playboy Steve Hartley. And you didn't hire me, but you did hire Chuck Singer, a.k.a. Ice Diamond. Any stories on him? Thanks and God bless.
I hired who? Ice Diamond.
Ice Diamond, real name Chuck Singer.
Brother, I've been hit on the head so many times, I do not remember that. I do not remember wearing a Stone Cold, what was it, a Stone Cold top and
bandana.
What? A bandana. And what?
Red,
Speedos?
Red silk speed. I may be adding the silk in. Speedos.
I think you're adding silk in. So, and where were we? On the beach?
No, Puerto Rico. I don't know. It's just, I'm trying to make it more sensuous. An encounter.
Oh, I don't remember this at all.
No.
So there are vast, vast swatches of my memory that is just gone. Puerto Rico, I remember some things, but I don't remember this. This must have been when I may have hired these guys after I went back after my first run there.
Yeah, it says 1998, winter of 1988.
Oh, that was the shits then.
Yeah. Anyway.
That was before IWA went in business.
Okay. Yeah, that was 99.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't go to work for him until like 2001. This one must have been with Carlos.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hire them. Carlos did.
Well,
I don't even know these guys. Say what?
I was going to say, I'm sorry, Sean, we couldn't answer your question, but I enjoy the image. Well, I'm not sure I enjoy the image, but it was a funny image in a Stone Cold bandana.
I would have to see a picture.
Okay. I don't have one. Next question. Tim Pruitt. Dutch fought Chavo Guerrero on the undercard of July 1980 in the Omni in Atlanta. That was a night Ole turned on Dusty Rhodes in a steel cage match. The fans were trying to climb the cage to help Dusty. Did Dutch witness any of this?
Yeah, I was there.
Go ahead.
But I remember getting ready for that match, and I'm trying to beat the crowd out. I didn't know what kind of finish they had. They had a hell of a riot in that Omni. They had a hell of a setup for it. Ole teamed with Dusty after all those years they tried to kill each other, and he begged Dusty, help me, help me, help me. And finally, Dusty, they got in the cage with Ole, and now they had him in the cage. So all three turned on him, and they had a hell of a fight, a hell of a riot. So while I didn't see any of it, I heard about it. They couldn't leave the Omni for about an hour and a half after the match. Because all you got to do in the Omni is just walk through and you can get right out. You couldn't, because they was getting people out. People were actually very, very incensed that they got Dusty down and beat the crap out of them. Of course, getting Dusty down, beating the crap out of them, you know, you get the blood, you get this, you get the gurney, you get the whole deal. So those heels had a very difficult time, and the Omni seated about 16,000. It was full, it was packed, and getting through the ringside area was tough. And then people thought they were throwing stuff. It was a mess. But I do remember that, and I do remember having the match with Chavo Guerrero that people were really, they were incensed because the match was a shits. They were throwing stuff at us. They said, damn, do something, you bastards. But I do remember having a match, but we didn't incense the people. They saved that to the end, and I'm glad I wasn't there for it.
I'll come back to Chavo in a couple of minutes, but I would like to ask you, because I've heard this before a couple of times, where a promoter would maybe ask the talent to stay behind for a particularly hot finish such as this.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you've experienced before where the promoter said, listen, it's going to be trouble, essentially. We might need you back here a bit longer.
Maybe. And I've heard that happening. They never asked me. I say, hey, that's your business. No, I didn't say that. No, if I'd have been asked to stay behind and help out, I don't know. What am I going to do? I mean, you got uniformed cops out there. If the people are not going to listen to them, they damn sure not going to listen to me.
Tell jokes over the PA.
And they don't like me anyway. I'm a heel out there anyway. So if I'd have been a baby face, maybe said, calm down, calm down, calm down. They might, but I'm a heel. Tell them to calm down. Hell, they may stick a knife in me. I don't know. But I would not be comfortable going out there. And if I had to help, I would. But if I didn't have to, you know, it's when you go out there, you're asking for the same thing they want to give the guys they're after. So they think you're with them.
We know how great Dusty was engendering loyalty and love from the fans. How great was Ole of generating
hatred?
Oh,
they hated. Oh, my God. He was. You hated Ole in real life. Ole could come up and talk to you in such a demeaning, I mean, challenging fashion. You wanted to slap him. Ole was an ultimate heat magnet. See, he got his reputation, of course, with Gene in the old Mid-Atlantic territory. So, and I may have told this story before. One night in Greenville, South Carolina, if I told that story, he tried to work his way back after a hot finish with Wahoo or somebody. And there was an old man there's cut the living shit out of Ole. He put like 70 stitches in him. He cut him like this way. So they took him to the hospital and they were looking for the guy that cut him. He said, an old, a real old bald headed guy. And 15 minutes later, they arrested Gene. No, they did find the guy. And he's an old guy in Greenville, South Carolina, that came every Monday night. He was in the same seat for years and years and years. And he finally just got so carried away one night, he cut Ole. And so they took him to court probably 3-4 months later. And I forgot what they did. I think they gave him Ole's hospital bill he had to pay. But they did the worst thing they could do to the guy in his mind is they banned him from ever attending another wrestling match ever at Memorial Hall in Greenville, South Carolina. And he died after that. He died about 4 months later. That was actually the worst thing they could do to him is ban him from his. See, he'd been used to going to this Greenville auditorium for at least 20 to 25 years, sitting in the same seat. So when they banned him from going for a lifetime, he just couldn't live with that, and he died about 4 months later. I heard that story.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he's like an attempted murderer, or at least, you know, commit like a fray. Good. Fuck off.
Well,
you don't have any. You don't have stabbing people. Get rid of him.
Well, yeah, I see your point, but he's a guy that loved wrestling so much, and they worked him to a point to get him so incensed that he would do that. I would say, well, you can come, but you got to sit up in the nosebleed section.
Or put him in a cage and hang him over the ring like they did with Cornette.
You could do that.
So I've got a feeling me and Disco Inferno will get on really well. I've never spoke to Disco, in fact. Do you know, specifically, what was it about Ole that the fans in general, not the wrestlers, because I know they've got the thing, but what was it about Ole? How would he incense them?
Chemistry. He was just a no-good bastard. You could tell automatically he was judging. He judged everybody, talked everybody like they're a piece of crap, even the announcers. And he was a good talker. I mean, if Ole Anderson came in your room right now and started talking to you, and you didn't, it doesn't matter whether you know who he is or not, but he would piss you off right away. Because he talked to you like hell, he owns you. Tell you to do something, do it now. I mean, and it was just something about Ole. Gene never said anything. Gene just looked ahead. I mean, Gene couldn't compete with Ole anyway. And the And if an angle didn't really draw a sellout, Ole would talk the rest of them in just to see him get his ass busted. So, but Ole almost, it was about 70 stitches in him. It was a, and he had a, I don't know if it was a hawk bill, but I can see that old man sitting around, especially in Greenville, South Carolina, sharpening his knife.
Huh.
And he lived for wrestling. So, and he probably hated Ole. He was probably a star around there for a while. And then when the people come tell him what the wrestling matches were like last Monday, he couldn't go. He should have donned a costume, or if he had a beard, shave his beard, look different, and go in there and somehow go in a different seat because people would look for him in the seat. But he never went, and they said that it killed him. Now, take that story for what it's worth. That's the story.
Ole was like one of the first millionaires from wrestling, wasn't he? Keep in mind, this is the 70s. You know, millionaire was a millionaire.
He had another business. He had a trucking company, didn't he?
Did he? I didn't know.
He had another business up in Minnesota, and he ran that business, and he booked Georgia and probably had points in the Georgia office. Jim Barnett loved Ole Anderson for some reason. And Jim, of course, was a flamboyant figure, but loved Ole. And Ole, he came to the back one time. I forgot where I was. He said, "Hey, Dutch," I said, "I can fire you." I said, "What?" This was, I talked last week about suing Jim Herd or suing WCW. And we was at TV one time. He said, "You know, I can fire you." I said, "Okay." Now, I thought I got along with it, but he said, "I can't, you know, Sting can't fire him." Oh, okay. I'm grieving. "Luger, I can't fire him." "Okay, but I can fire you. I can fire you in a minute if I wanted to. You know, I can fire you," and just kept on and on and on. I said, "Okay, you got my vote. You can fire me." So I didn't know what kind of reaction he was looking for, but finally I just agreed with him. And he walked off. I want to mark it down to where he was ribbing me and messing with me. But, yeah, he could fire me at any time if he wanted to. But then he came up to me and he said, "Hey, come here." I said, "Oh, God, he's going to fire me." And that's when he asked me to do the commentary with Tony Schiavone on Monday night. So, and I did it for like a year and a half. I did the commentary. So I don't know where he got the idea that I could do comedy. I think somebody told him or something, but I did it for like a year and a half and enjoyed the hell out of it. Tony Schiavone, great, great guy to work with.
You said you were going to get in touch with Tony Schiavone.
I did.
On last week's episode somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's another call I got to make.
Yeah.
Hey, send me a note.
I'll send you a note.
Listen, I've been hit on the head a couple of 100,000 times. How many times I got to go over this? So I will call Tony. I think I'd had a number on him. And who else was I going to call?
Bradshaw.
Yep.
I did say we were going to talk about Chavo Guerrero. I think we're going to save that for another time because we've got loads more questions. We're going to get as many as we can in before our allotted time is up. Next question, Don Catterall. Do you have any thoughts on TNA ring girl SoCal Val? I'll save the rest of the question for afterwards, but SoCal Val memories.
She's a good girl. She was. I don't know how she got there. I really don't. But they ended up with her being a ring girl or something. And I think she kept a low profile. She never was like in any trouble or anything. And she was good at what she did. She was. But she talked to the right people, I guess. See, I didn't hire ring girls. I didn't have nothing to do with them. But, and I know she was supposed to be I guess she was a wrestler too, was she?
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, I don't know. I don't remember really nobody wrestling for TNA.
No, I don't either. But I think she was. And then there wasn't a place for her or something. And then she found her a spot somehow, and more power to her. So she came down to get in wrestling, and she got into wrestling.
As far as I can tell, she's had 7 matches. One of them against...
She's had how many?
7. One of them against Curry Man, apparently, in Canada.
Oh, yeah. That was good.
We'll have to talk about Curry Man at some point.
Curry Man. That was good.
We'll talk about Curry Man at some point. So, right, so the rest of the question was, the only things I remember, this is from Dom, about SoCal Val was that she got injured at taking a black hole slam from Abyss, and that she was also written to marry Jay Lethal at one point, which made Sonjay Dutt sad.
That's a story we told with him, which was a good story. Because now you got something, marriage that most people can identify with. And hey, the black hole slam that Abyss gave her, I don't know if she got hurt. I think it was a angle where she got hurt, because it looks like you get hurt when he gives it to anybody, because he gives it good. So to take that little, she probably only weighs like 120 when he swirls her around and drops on her. It looks like he kills her. So when we take, if you even watch that in the arena and you bring medical personnel out, you naturally assume that she legitimately got hurt, because he did it good. So see, the thing about Abyss, he was a good worker. He used to do spots, and I used to get on him all the time. Don't do that spot. You're 320. You don't do spots like that. You stand, and finally he got it. You stand your ground. But what he was doing was, he was showing all the other guys, hey, I can do this stuff. I'll take this stuff. I'm not going to eat you up. You won't get nothing. He was trying to get along with the baby faces that he worked with. I understood that. But we were trying to get him over, and we eventually got him over, because Abyss was a good gimmick, a really good gimmick. Yeah, I remember at the time I told you when I gave it to him, right?
Yes, we've covered on. I'll add my memories. I actually saw her from afar anyway this year. I always remember from TNA, they always filmed her. She was always standing sort of like legs akimbo slightly on the ramp, and the camera would always go whoosh. And I even got the photo, I'll show it to you. For the Your Eyes Only poster.
Yeah, they loved those shots like that.
Next question. Spencer Yates. Hello, Dutch. We've been told for years how wrestlers have been shortchanged on pay by promoters. Dusty Rhodes, in his book, highlighted an example of him getting a low payoff down in Florida in the early 70s, while house show attendance was up. Eddie Graham muttered to him, shut the F up, and then gave Dusty a much larger payoff under the office cut of the house. Eddie was taking a large slice for the office than the roster, and just kicking a little to Dusty. Since the wrestling promotions had first counts of the house, it would be easy for them to adjust the attendance numbers to their own financial benefit. My question for you is this. In your own personal experience, who were the worst payoff promoters, not necessarily from a bad house or down territory, but promoters who were just blatantly effing their rosters out of money?
No, I think most of them. Most of the offices back in the day before WWE and maybe AEW, the promoters took what they wanted. Always remember, the promoters got first count. The way the, if it was by, formula, it was by thirds. Say you have a $10,000 house. Well, a third comes off that for expenses, renting the building, the ring crew, advertising. So I've been $3,000, $3,300. So, and the remaining 66% was supposed to be split half to a third to talent and a third to the office, to the promotion. So that would mean the promotion that night would have made $3,300, and the talent would have made $3,300. I'm doing it, you know, on a 10 scale because it's easier to understand. But say you had 12 guys on the card. So 12 into 3,300 is how much? Can you figure that up real quick?
Oh, give me the thing again. What was it?
12 into 3,300.
Just under three times. Like 2.6 times. 2.7 times.
Okay. That means that the average payoff on that card should have been $270. And, of course, your first and second match, say they make $150, and the middle makes $270. So you take the rest of it, you give it to your main event. So your main event should have made $400. And that's the way it went. But they didn't do that. They probably went out and reported the house at $8,800. They pocket $1,200 right off the bat. You don't know. And it's the way they do business. And they see nothing wrong with it. So now you're dealing with a lower figure. And the promotion is still making money because they're going to get a third of that $8,800. But the talent's money goes down. They just don't tell anybody that. All promotions did that. The best payoff guy in the business, there were a few. Jim Barnett was one of them. Very good payoff guy. When you work with him, you made money. Paul Bosch out of Houston, you made good money. And this is why, and in Florida, sometimes you made money, sometimes you didn't. Memphis was the same way. I think it's what they had to pay for that week. But of course, they don't come and tell the talent, well, you know, I took X number of dollars out of the total house because we have to pay this and pay that. You know, that was never brought up. So if you say you didn't like your payoff, say, I didn't like my payoff with Jerry Jarrett. I said, hey, I didn't like that last week. And if he really wanted to keep me, which he has on a couple of times, he said, I'll make it up to you this week. He'd make it up, but guess where he'd make it up with? The talent money that he was going to pay them, he's going to pay it out anyway. He'd just take more of that for me. Still, the talent was getting screwed, but he was trying to shut me up, and I would just take money that he should have paid them.
So aside from the best payoff guys, which is a different sort of kettle of fish in a sense, so who were the most honest payoff guys then? Apart from, because you mentioned Paul Bosch, who's renowned for being a great payoff guy and really honest as well. Were there any other guys who were particularly honest, and were there any guys that you found particularly dishonest when you could see that the houses were up and you were getting a lower payoff?
That's about all wrestling promotions back in the day. That was about all of them. See, when you're with a pack of thieves anyway, so when you're with thieves, so you expect thievery. So, and what are you going to do? You're going to bitch and moan, but you still were making more on that job than the last one you had. So you had to take the good with the bad. I have brought it up a couple times. I got more money the next week, but it was a touch and go situation. The worst payoff guy I ever saw was Nick Goodless in Nashville. Except when I worked for him, I got a guarantee. So I made the same money every week. So these guys that would come in, they're not making any money. I'm thinking, Don't you know his reputation? He doesn't really pay unless you get the guarantee. I remember one time I got my check and it wasn't what it's supposed to be. I went back to his office, knocked on the door. I said, hey, the check's not right. What is it, boy? I said, it's supposed to be this. Oh, okay. He knew that. He signed the check. You know, the crew wasn't that big. And so he just wrote me another check to make the difference. And out the door I went. It never happened again, but you got to stay. If it happens, you got to tell them right away. Mm-hmm. Or then they'll keep doing it unless they're checked on it. So the next time I went in there, I took a gun and I shot in his floor. I aimed for his foot and I missed. but it never happened again.
You got the message. I'll give you two more, and then we'll close this episode out. Rob from the Night Shift. So maybe he's a Commodore. We don't know. Yep. Hi, Dutch. I love that song, by the way, anyway. Hi, Dutch and James. Absolutely love the podcast and listen every week on my night shifts. Does Dutch have any rib stories that are shocking that he can tell us, but leave the actual names out of it so he can tell the worst ones he's heard? Many thanks, both.
There was Don Fargo and Jackie Fargo, the Fabulous Fargos. They were traveling one night, and they were drinking. And this hitchhiker, they stopped to pick him up. So, and they had a pretty long way to go. So they picked him up and asked him where he's going. So they start talking. And then, and I don't think they planned this. It just happened. They get into an argument. And one of them says, "You lying bastard." And I said, "Hey, don't talk. Hey." And then they would turn and try to get the guy in it. And, "Well, who do you believe?" And, "Hey, guys, I don't know. I'm not in this." And one of them says, "I'll kill you." And what? And that's getting serious, right? Then they pull over. And then, you know, they pull over, there's some woods there. And they go down there and arguing, and the guy's watching. And all of a sudden, bam, bam, he hears the shots. And the other ones come running about the car. And he said, "If you say a word, I'll blow your friggin' brains out." Oh, God. And then he takes off down the road. And then he don't go far. He says, "No, you get out here because they'll think you did it." It was something like that. And then the other one come out of the, now he comes out of the woods. He's laughing. And the other, but the guy, the hitchhiker, he didn't think it was funny. So the other guy gets back in the car and they want to know, "Hey, you want to go with us?" He said, "No, I'm okay." So they left that hitchhiker on the side of the road. I remember hearing that story years and years ago. That may not be the way it went, but it was something like that.
We'll finish it up on this one. Crichton 2x4b523p asks, "Road Dog on his podcast once told a story about you whipping half to death a jobber called The Worm during a match in Birmingham, Alabama, or something like that. Could you elaborate on what this guy did to deserve the lashing?"
No, well, it was set up. We asked him, could he do it? And he said, yeah. So I had a match with him. Then he was outside. Then I do an interview in the ring, and then I go over there and I'm trying to demonstrate what's going to happen to Bob Armstrong, I think. So I beat the crap out of the damn worm again in the ring and throw him out. And then I say something like, "I got a better idea." And I go outside where I got enough to, it was a long whip, but like a 10 footer, brother. I asked him, I said, "Hey, this is, the end's not going to hit you, but the bulk of it will." And he was really a white, pale guy. And you could tell any kind of disruption on that skin would really show up. And I threw about 3 or 4 shots across him. And I threw it in such a way that you could hear the whip crack on the other end. That wasn't hitting him. The actual whip was hitting him. But most of the power was gone. But they finally run some people out there and got me off of him. He was all, I mean, it just red. It looked brutal. I hated to say I took credit for it, but Bob Armstrong grabbed the mic and he says, "You know, when I see you, you're going to be getting this instead of me." So, and we drew some money with that. Bob Armstrong did a very, very credible interview because you believed him. So if he said he's going to whip your ass, he's going to whip your ass. So, and I think I was getting ready to go somewhere then. I was only there for like a month or two. See, because I used to fill in some of these places when I think I was going to Charlotte. So I filled in there for a month and did good business for a month there with me and Bob Armstrong. It was good.
Do you know, all these podcasts we've done, I don't think we've ever told a story about Bob Armstrong. How many times did he wrestle him?
Quite a bit. Wrestling Bob Armstrong was a night off. I mean, he was over like Rover. He'd go out there, and he called himself the Bullet later on, because I think he lost a loser leave town match, and he came back as the Bullet. Of course, everybody knew it was Barb Armstrong, except stupid ass heels. Heels are stupid. I mean, even their attorneys are stupid. They can't look at this guy. I mean, how many people could have a body like Bob Armstrong, because he was really big up here, and he had legs like buggy whips. And he used to do a thing where he would stand there and he'd do his, you know, knees together with the hands, and they'd go back and forth. He was entertaining, and he played a really good entrance song. And when you got him down and you started beating on him, people waiting for that comeback. He had a very, very explosive comeback, and he had great timing, and why he throw those chops, why? And he was really fun to work with, easy to get heat on, and that's what you wanted in a baby face. You don't want to have to beat him 2 hours to get heat on him. You just wanted to do a little bit of something to him and get him down and start beating him up, getting the best of him. Then the people, they'll give it about, I don't know. Bob, when I worked with him, was probably close to, I don't know, he was probably in his mid-50s, but still had a hell of a comeback. So, and he was very easy to work with. And I remember my last match, it was a loser leave town match with him. And, of course, I lost. And I said, I'm coming back. But if I hadn't been going to Charlotte, I should have come back under the mask again. And everything you could see was have the mustache hanging out. And I tell him, I'll unmask if you will, which meant both of us would be run off, and he wouldn't do it. But I went to Charlotte from then on. But Bob was a really, really good guy. He really was.
Yeah, I think with Bob is that he's sort of like the definition of a regional hit. And I think he could have taken his act further, but he always seemed to just be just in a really sort of tight area in the U.S.
I don't think, well, he started in Atlanta and he migrated to Pensacola, where that territory was based out of. And I think he liked it there, raised his family there. Most of his sons were in wrestling anyway.
All of them.
Every one of them?
Yeah.
There was one of them that was in, he got out, though. What was
Scott,
his name?
Steve, Brad.
Steve got out.
Brian.
Yeah. And Brad was probably the best of all of them, because he had the moves, he had the body. Well, if Brad could talk like Road Dogg, he'd be a main event anywhere. So, and Road Dogg, he was a great talker, but they kind of based out of Pensacola, because I guess when his kids, it just put them in school and let them, he didn't want to be changing them around all over the place. So, and he did a good job. He'd get a good job with his kids.
Definitely good for him. One very last thing is, did he have any issues, I mean on-screen issues, with Bob when he was the commissioner in Smoky Mountain Wrestling?
Other than work issues?
No, I'm talking about on-screen fun, you know, not like behind-the-scenes stuff, obviously.
No, he was fun just letting him do an interview. He'd look at you, and I was just an announcer, like a commentator there, so he wouldn't direct any comments to me, but he would direct them to Cornette. It was entertaining as hell, because Smoky Mountain Wrestling was a throwback anyway. And when he'd bring Bob out there, and Bob never dressed in wrestling outfit. He'd always dress in like a nice tie and a shirt. He wouldn't wear a coat and wear that mask. Oh, he looked so silly. But anyway, and he was out there talking, and he was the commissioner. They did a good job there. I mean, people believe Bob, and they believe what he said. And Cornette sold it like a prince, sold it like a champ, and all of his stuff. Smoky Mountain, most of their stuff got over. Because we would do it in some of the damnedest. So far back in the hills, I think they had to pump daylight into some of these towns. And you would go around a curve and around another curve. If somebody said, oh, where's this town at? Oh, it's just around the next curve. Well, after about 30 curves, you said, what curve is this guy talking about? Because, and you don't know this, but if you go back far enough in those hills of West Virginia, it's been documented that the outside influences in some of these towns that didn't exist. And, well, maybe I shouldn't tell that. Or you want me to tell it?
I also want you to tell it.
Now your interest is up.
Yeah, what? How can you just say, oh, maybe I shouldn't tell this? At what point would I say, all right, don't then. No, do.
Have you ever seen Deliverance?
Yes. Oh, no, I haven't seen Deliverance. I know the famous bits. So.
You have never seen Deliverance?
I've never seen Deliverance.
When they went way back in the hills and they found the little banjo picker boy?
No.
Well, he was a victim of incest way back in the hills. And they're so far back in there, outsiders don't go in and they don't go out. So I could see where incest could exist. But he was the prime example of it. So in his eyes were going cross-eyed. It was a genetic defect amongst the same family.
There was a story here. No, not here, but I think it was actually some family in West Virginia. There was so much inbreeding since the 1800s in the family that they were blue.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah?
They were blue. Yeah, you can look them up. They're called the Blue Family, I think. I heard that story and I read about it. So, and it's documented. So, is it the people's fault? Well, yeah, they did it, but they couldn't get out and nobody could get to them. Can you imagine me stuck back in those, all these things happening in the world, but you're so far back in the mountains, you don't even know about it. You're in your own world and you can't even get out.
Just thinking everyone's there just Smurfs.
There was a guy that went back and studied them. And they didn't want to talk to him because they didn't trust him, didn't know him. He was an outsider, but he finally won their trust and he got back and he found them. They had inbred so much that they were blue. And can you imagine getting up every day and going into the coal mine?
Mm.
I couldn't do that either.
No.
I mean, I could do it if I had to do it. But I wouldn't want to do it.
Maybe that's where James Cameron got the idea for Avatar. Who knows? Who can say? Between them and the Smurfs.
Heard about the Blue Family, right?
Yeah, I read about it, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's true.
I've actually seen photos. Freaky.
See, I used to do interviews. I talk about, it was called the black lung disease that coal miners would get.
Mm.
And I did an interview one time talking about, I don't want to get too close to you people with that black lung disease up there. Hell, you might give it to me. But see, I didn't know how serious they took that. So I'm at one of those shows up there, and a guy came up to me, and he went, very serious, too. Pretty good-sized guy. Dutch? I said, yeah. I didn't like the way you talked about that black lung disease. I says, well, you know, I'm just talking. He said, no, my daddy died of that. I went, oh, shit. So he said, I don't want you talking about that no more. And I said, well, you got my... He looked pretty damn serious, too. And I didn't have anything in my hands. He could have had a knife on him or anything.
Was he blue?
So he wasn't blue, but he was damn serious. And I never talked about it again because that was a serious subject there. And he, you know, stay in your lane. Mm. So he was one ticket and I didn't need to say it again, and I didn't.
On that note, we shall shut down this podcast. I'll do the I don't have to do the plugs. We did them all at the beginning of the show. So if you want your questions answered on next Tuesday's episode, or at least the chance to, email questionsfordutch@gmail.com with your poser. And also, if you can put your name and where you're from as well. I mean, it's been 15 of these and I've not actually said that. But yeah, put your name and where you're from, and because I just like to know where people are. But for now, thank you very much for watching. We will catch you again on Friday. We the people.
What he said.